Reineres Vorschlag, nehmt das Salz in Acht und in der Zeit von Diskussion seid ihr frei zu stellen Fragen und sich herauszusagen wegen jedem Referat von allen früherigen Sessions. Jetzt, wir öffnen die heutige Sitzung und der erste Referat wird halten Professor Ezra Mendelssohn von Columbia Universität New York unter dem Kapitel Führerschaft und Masse in der jüdischen Arbeiterbewegung in zarischen Russland, Wurzeln von Konflikt. Professor Mendelssohn, das Wort.
Thank you very much. I'm not a professor, but unfortunately...
Well, so it's written on your...
if I ever will be, but at any rate... The Jewish labor movement in Tsarist Russia, like all mass movements, was confronted by internal opposition to the established leadership. Such opposition, usually reflecting worker dissatisfaction with the policies of the intelligentsia, ranged from the scarcely articulated discontent of the masses to a variety of organized protest. I shall attempt here to describe these movements of opposition, proceeding chronologically from the circles of the 1880s up to the founding of the Independent Jewish Labor Party in Minsk in 1901. In the 1880s, radical circles were founded in various cities of the Pale. These circles were conducted by Russified Jewish intellectuals and attended by Jewish artisans. The goal of the leaders was to create a worker elite which would stand in the forefront of the revolutionary movement, the Russian revolutionary movement. The creation of such an elite, they believed, was possible only through an intensive education campaign. The attainment of knowledge would enable the circle member to reach the necessary level of consciousness, by which they meant an understanding of the forces of nature and society required of a revolutionary. The circles were essentially educational institutions. Their leaders were the teachers, and their worker members comprised the student body, as it were. They remained throughout peaceful groups, possessing special libraries and offering courses on as many as three different levels at once. The workers would advance from one level to the next as their education progressed. The first step was to teach the workers Russian, after which they proceeded to an examination of basic issues, such as hours and wages. But the concept of knowledge was not restricted to what we might call practical issues. On the contrary, the circle leaders determined to enlighten the workers in all areas of thought. Thus, Leon Bernstein in Vilna taught his pupils, and I quote, how the world was created, the sun and the earth, the seas and the volcanoes. He also lectured, quote, on the life of peoples, beginning with the wild tribes and ending with the English, with their parliament and trade unions. In another circle, among the topics discussed were the emergence of social classes, slavery, serfdom, and capitalism. Circle members attended the theater, read Darwin and Mill, and studied the masterpieces of Russian and world literature. Lev Yogishis, one of the leaders of the Vilna movement, went so far as to bring a skeleton into his circle during a lecture on anatomy. In the light of these examples, to which many more could be added, it is no wonder that the revolutionary aims of the leaders were occasionally obscured by their passion to instruct the workers. Nor is it surprising to find that some circle members were more interested in attaining knowledge than in becoming revolutionaries. The circles were intended to be schools of socialism, but the workers sometimes regarded them only as schools, placing all their hopes in the power of learning and ignoring occasionally the revolutionary implications. This attitude was well expressed by a Vilna worker who stated in 1892 that, quote, like a faithful mother, knowledge will guide us peacefully over the sea of tears and pain into the land of life. Jewish artisans thus seized upon the circle as an opportunity to learn Russian and to enjoy the forbidden fruits of world culture. As Martov recounts in his memoirs, for some, the, quote, circles were only a means of acquiring knowledge and a personal escape from the gloom in which the worker masses subsisted. Inevitably, this attitude led to defections. Some workers left the circles to become externs in the hope of entering a university. Others left their provincial cities for, for Petersburg, attracted by the rich cultural life of the capital. In addition, there was a general tendency to ape the intelligentsia, which was revered not for its revolutionary ideals, but for its cultural achievements. Some workers came to share the common disdain for Yiddish and to look down upon the uneducated masses from whose ranks they had originally sprung. They went about, in Mikhailovich's words, quote, with a Russian book under their arms and the Russian language on their lips. In the early 90s, the latent discord between workers and intellectuals, deriving from their different motives in joining the movement, came into the open. The intellectuals, realizing that they were creating a worker elite alienated from the very class they were to lead, set out on a new course. They determined to burst the confines of the circle and appeal to a much larger audience. Turning to the hitherto neglected masses, they placed themselves at the head of the struggle to improve the economic condition of the Jewish proletariat. As the role of the leadership changed, the position of the circle member was threatened. Fearing that the switch from peaceful propaganda to economic agitation meant an end to the cultural work they prized so highly, as well as an end to their privileged status vis-à-vis the masses, the workers were bound to protest. This is the background, in short, of the so-called oppositsiya, opposition, which originated in Vilna under the leadership of Avraham Gordon. Gordon succeeded in gathering around him all those who rejected the new agitation campaign. His program consisted of two major elements. First, he reaffirmed the old notion that only through knowledge and the rising level of individual consciousness can progress become a reality. No real improvement can result from strikes and other economic activities. Thus, Gordon longs for the good old days of the 1880s, when, in his words, cultural work was carried on in a, quote, holy fire of enthusiasm. Second, Gordon denounced what he considered the treason of the intelligentsia. For him, the intellectual's only asset was his learning, which must be transmitted to the people. The new role of the intellectual was a clear sign of betrayal. Indeed, history is replete with examples of the intelligentsia's desire to delude the people and use them for their own selfish aims. And here Gordon brings in, for example, the case of the French Revolution. The whole agitation campaign, Gordon believed, was the intelligentsia's way of preserving their monopoly on that most precious of all commodities, knowledge. Gordon's views were widely held. In Vilna, the opposition split the movement into two hostile camps for a while, nor did it die out with the eventual success of the new tactics. As late as 1901, a Gordon supporter set up a press in his apartment in order to spread the old opposition doctrines. Opposition groups emerged in other cities, affecting both the Jewish and the Russian movements. In Minsk, an opposition group shared some of Gordon's tenets, along with its own nationalist deviations. In Homel and Brest-Litovsk, worker opposition groups were also formed. In the program of the Bialystok Group of Worker Revolutionaries, one finds the same rejection of purely economic activity, the same hostility towards the intelligentsia, and the same attachment to the circle ideal of knowledge that Gordon had preached. The Bialystok opposition had ties with a similar group in Grodno, the Jewish Workers' Union, which characteristically rejected strikeism and wanted to give the workers a more substantial knowledge of socialist doctrine. The opposition of the circle workers was never a majority movement. The workers clearly needed the intellectuals, and the desperate economic plight of the masses was fertile soil for the new trade union movement. But Gordon's ideas never lost their attraction, as one final example will demonstrate. In Minsk, after the arrests of 1898, the movement was forced to make a fresh start. The leaders, favoring economic agitation, found themselves up against the old opposition once again. In 1899, some workers held a demonstration to protest against the proponents of economic action. This, we should note, occurred after years of strike activity in Minsk. Gordon's heritage of hostility towards the intelligentsia, coupled with an emphasis on cultural work, had taken deep roots among a certain section of the Jewish proletariat. It had its influence, as we shall see, on the opposition trends of the agitation period. The transition from circle propaganda to economic agitation completely altered the character of the movement. As Gordon had feared, the great emphasis on learning disappeared. Cultural work was not discarded, but it was implemented on a much more practical level. The homely brochures of Gozhansky and the feuilletons in the socialist press replaced Darwin and anatomy. The old circle elite was submerged by a new wave of recruits whose only language was Yiddish and whose level of consciousness as they understood it, was very low. The Kasse or Schodke Council became the organizational backbone of the movement. In the larger cities, each trade organized a Schodke, which in turn elected representatives to an all-trade council, usually referred to as the agitation Schodke. Committees consisting of elected and co-opted members directed the movement on a local level. Later, these committees merged to form the General Jewish Labor Bund, the supreme authorities of which were the central and foreign committees. The circle leader was replaced by a new figure, the agitator, who organized the masses and led the economic struggle. The intellectuals, concentrated in the local committees and in the higher echelons of the party organization, supervised the movement from above. They helped put out the underground press, printed proclamations, and maintained contact with other cities. And they also planned political activities, such as demonstrations. They did not usually take a direct part in the economic struggle. Above all, it was the strike movement which dominated the early years of the agitation period. A wave of strikes transformed the Pale into a battleground between worker and employer. Strikeism became the order of the day, and the slogan, a 12-hour day from 7 to 7, became the rallying cry of the movement. Under these radically changed conditions, new trends of opposition emerged, which may conveniently be grouped into three major categories. Let me begin with the opposition to the leadership's position on the issue of terror. The economic struggle of the Jewish proletariat was marked by terrorist activities of all kinds, both economic and political. Attacks on employers, Christian strikebreakers, and informers were very frequent occurrences. Terrorist acts were carried out largely by the new recruits to the movement, workers who had never attended the circles and who had little regard for party discipline. Their actions were fostered by the Russian revolutionary tradition itself. And in fact, in many instances, the martyrs of the people's will became heroes for the Jewish workers. The leadership, opposed to terror on principle, but ambivalent in practice, did its best to combat this rather unwelcome trend. Anti-terror articles appeared in the socialist press, and resolutions condemning terror were passed at Bundist congresses and at congresses of the Berchter and Garbebund. Workers were informed that terrorism was, quote, shameful, and that, quote, one must talk with the strikebreakers, one must make them understand, for they act only from ignorance. How effective these admonitions were is quite debatable. What is evident is that the masses were dissatisfied with the leadership's attitude, and that this dissatisfaction occasionally expressed itself in organized opposition. In Vilna, for example, special groups of boyeviks, fighters, were established to carry out terrorist acts. It was from this background that Hirsch Leckert emerged to make his famous attentat on the governor of Vilna in 1902. The Leckert affair is a rather good indication of the extent to which pro-terrorist sentiments had permeated the movement. The Vilna committee split over the proposed assassination, and the fifth conference of the Bund, meeting shortly after Leckert's execution, squared the circle by adopting a resolution favoring organized vengeance, organisierte Rache. This resolution was immediately attacked by the Foreign Committee and was rescinded at the Bund's Fifth Congress. Leckert's deed exacerbated the conflict over terror. In Vilna, the workers accused the committee of responsibility in Leckert's execution, as it had failed to lend complete support to his plan. In 1903, a special terrorist group composed of former Bundists appeared in Riga. In Grodno, a group of strikers at Sherashevsky's cigarette factory left the movement after a dispute over terror. In Lodz, some 60 workers left the Bund for the same reason, only to return with the acceptance of organized vengeance. In Bialystok, those workers who demanded action against police repressions swelled the ranks of the anarchist group Barba struggle, which later became a factor to reckon with in the revolution of 1905. If the unlettered masses expressed their dissatisfaction with the leadership's attitude towards terror, the more advanced workers accused the intellectuals of running the movement in an undemocratic, monopolistic manner. In Dvinsk and Vitebsk, for example, we hear of enmity between workers and intellectuals deriving from this accusation. In the former city, the workers succeeded in excluding the intellectuals from the local committee. In 1903, an opposition group in Minsk demanded that only workers be active in the local committee. In Hommel, the workers, annoyed at the extreme conspiratorial nature of the organization, called for more democracy. The leaders replied with a very angry proclamation advising the workers, quote, not to play with the word Democrat. Tendencies towards centralization, crowned by the resolution on organization at the Bund's fifth conference, confirmed the fears of the workers that the movement was being taken out of their hands. The program's implementation met with determined resistance in various cities, Lodz, for example. The most important opposition movement, however, derived from the all-important issue of economic versus political action. I have already noted that the early years of the agitation period were characterized by a trade union orientation. The masses of workers attracted to the movement in those early years were motivated above all by a desire to improve their economic conditions. The leaders hoped to guide the workers from an awareness of their economic needs to an awareness of the political situation, from strikes to political activities. They never tired of pointing out that only through basic social and economic and political change could the lot of the masses be really improved. This task was naturally made easier by the Tsarist police and gendarmes, who brought home to the workers, as the intellectuals never could, the close connection between economic and political struggle in Russia. Despite this, the leaders were not always successful. Frequently, the workers concerned themselves only with the economic struggle. They remained indifferent or even hostile to politics and to the leaders who urged political action. Indifference to politics is much in evidence in the early days of the Jewish labor movement. In some cities, the movement originated on a legal basis, with the workers attempting to gain their economic demands through legal means without antagonizing the authorities. The most obvious example of this is the widespread use of Catherine II's old forgotten law restricting the artisan's working day to 12 hours. This law was brought to the attention of the Vilna socialist intelligentsia, who used it as a means to convince the workers to strike for a 12-hour day. As late as 1897, the Vilna proletariat was still being urged to base their demands on the old statute. Significantly, it was also utilized in Mohilev in 1903, Minsk in 1894, Brest-Litovsk in the middle 1890s, and in Bialystok in 1894 also, and probably elsewhere, although these are the only examples I could find. Other tactics were also employed by workers seeking to operate within the narrow framework of Tsarist legislation. In Minsk, for example, the clerk sent a petition to the governor requesting that the stores be closed earlier. In Hommel in 1894, the workers petitioned the local Bureau of Trade for a shorter working day. To avoid the prohibition on strikes, which in Russia was based on the breach of contract principle, workers would strike at the beginning of their term of employment. Kishinev workers, to cite another example, announced their strikes 2 weeks in advance, this being the minimum amount of time required to advise the employer of one's intention to leave work. The workers also appealed to factory inspectors for aid against their employers. The Bundist leadership waged a long campaign against this practice, proof of the workers' stubborn belief that the inspector was really on their side. In Krenke, the inspectors were referred to as, quote, fathers, until, in the words of a Bundist proclamation, the workers discovered that, quote, he is not their father and they are not his children. But despite frequent warnings of this sort, workers continued to look to the inspector as their ally. In fact, inspectors often did side with workers during labor disputes. Usually, the legal tactics of the workers failed. Petitions to governors and appeals to inspectors remained unanswered, forcing the workers to resort to illegal strikes. But there remained a definite hostility to political involvement among a certain section of the proletariat. The, quote, indescribable fear of politics ascribed by Pesachsen to the Lodz working class may be exaggerated, but there are indications of a hardcore resistance to the political orientation of the movement. In 1900, a proclamation to the Bialystok clerks created a disturbance for the simple reason that, at the end of the proclamation, socialism was mentioned. The workers in the Schotkas claimed that this would frighten away the masses and that the proclamation should discuss only the daily needs of the workers. In Warsaw, to cite another example, some workers actually accused the Bundist leaders of having caused police repressions. According to the local Bundist paper, They insisted that, quote, workers should not be involved in politics. In Vilna, some workers refused to join May Day demonstrations. Instead, they demanded, quote, purely worker holidays and would have nothing to do with political action. This latter incident in Vilna took place in 1903, probably under the influence of the Zubatov doctrine of legalism. I should like to conclude this paper with a discussion of the Zubatov movement as it affected the Jewish proletariat. Zubatovism, as presented to the Jewish workers, was based on the notion that the workers, like everyone else, are motivated entirely by enlightened self-interest. Their only aim is to better their material and cultural standards. If the workers are allowed to pursue these aims in peace, they will remain indifferent to politics. It follows that the proletariat cannot profit from an alliance with the intelligentsia, whose own interests are quite different. The intelligentsia wishes to divert the workers into a senseless political struggle which can only harm their just demands for economic and cultural improvement. This improvement can only come about, in fact, if the workers abandon illegality and ally themselves with the government. The workers should found unions operated on democratic principles without the interference of the intelligentsia. The government would support the workers' struggle for a decent wage and shorter hours. The appeal of such an argument to the Jewish proletariat, in light of what I've said, should be clear. The Zubatov doctrine could attract both the proponents of the old opposition and those who had supported the various opposition trends of the agitation period. On the one hand, it held out the possibility of peaceful cultural activity. On the other, it denounced political action, championed legalism, and appealed directly to the economic interests of the masses. In addition, it was strongly opposed to the intelligentsia. As for the idea of a labor movement allied with the authorities, in this case with the gendarmes, if the workers had been prepared to cooperate with governors and inspectors, they would not object to cooperation with the police. Zubatovism's appeal to the traditional discontents within the Jewish movement was enhanced by developments around the turn of the century within the Jewish labor movement. There were growing difficulties with the strike movement. Strikes were now being held not to win new victories, but to stave off fresh defeats. At the same time, the Bund was attempting to centralize and politicize the movement. Just as the transition from propaganda to agitation resulted in the opposition of the early 90s, so the transformation of a trade union-oriented movement into a centralized organization stressing political action paved the way for the founding of the Independent Jewish Labor Party in Minsk in 1901. The actual inroads made by Zubatovism are very difficult to measure, but it is clear that many important centers were affected by its propaganda. The Hommel Bundist organ, for example, noted that Zubatov had attracted some, quote, stupid workers who believe the dog being Zubatov. Such workers probably existed everywhere. And in fact, there is evidence that Zubatovism had a very strong appeal throughout the Pale. But it was in Minsk that the movement really took root, thanks in part, at least, to the support of the gendarme chief Vasiliev. Here, the Independent Jewish Labor Party, armed with its slogan, bread and knowledge, and I would emphasize this slogan, bread and knowledge, succeeded in attracting a mass following. Vereins, or unions, were established in the trades and carried on a carefully planned economic struggle with the support of the police. Employers, knowing of the connections between the police and the workers, were forced to make concessions. Strikeism, in quotes, became a very popular worker sport. The independents paid special attention to cultural work. Lectures and courses were arranged by a cultural commission, literary evenings were held, and the like. Each Verein possessed a library and carried on cultural work among its members. The Painters Verein, for example, announced that it would concentrate on raising the, quote, cultural level of our trade. The protocol book of the Carpenters Verein, which is available in the Bund archives, reveals a similar emphasis on cultural activity. The intellectuals in the movement were assigned the role of spiritual mentors. The economic struggle was left in the hands of the workers themselves. The independents remained active until 1903, when for a variety of reasons, which I won't go into here, they were forced to disband. They represented, as I have tried to show, the culmination of many opposition movements which had previously challenged the authority of the established leadership. To understand these movements, despite the fact that they reflected only the views of the minority, is, I think, to add a dimension to one's understanding of the Russian Jewish labor movement under the leadership of the Bund. Thank you.
Danke, Frank Pendelson.